What happens when we reach the Great Attractor? Could astronomers hide their knowledge of UFOs? And why doesn't NASA look directly for life like they did with Viking? Answers to all these questions and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers, as always, wherever you are, across my channel. If a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I will gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Christian Desalier, given the recent uptick in aerial phenomena reports of UAP UFO incidents, could any genuine extraterrestrial contact be effectively hidden from the professional astronomy community by governments? There is no way that you could hide the regular arrival of spacecraft from space and have it not be noticed by astronomers. You know, I mentioned the incredible impact that the Vera Rubin telescope is going to have on the astronomical community. It's going to be watching and scanning the entire night sky, looking for anything that's changing from night to night to night. And so, you know, if a alien mothership wants to arrive in any direction that is seen by Vera Rubin, it's going to get picked up. And I think, you know, like a lot of people think that the way astronomy works is somehow that there's a bunch of government astronomers and they are doing their work and then they show their higher ups at the government and the government approves whether or not they're allowed to go ahead with their research. But it doesn't work like that at all. Like, astronomy is a collection of professional and amateur astronomers. You've got small observatories, large observatories, space telescopes run by dozens of different countries in different locations around the world. There are tens of thousands of astronomers, and they work for universities, or they work for research institutes, or they work for government. The Vatican has an astronomer and their own observatory, and that they are constantly doing their work, constantly scanning the night sky. They are writing papers, and they're not going through any kind of gatekeeper. They're not going through some sort of censor process. They're just writing their paper. They're dropping it on the internet. There's things like the archive where people will share the first draft of their science paper. There's the astronomer's telegram where astronomers are just communicating in these, you know, huge sort of Discord-like server where they're talking to each other. Anyone who wants can go in and listen and over and read. All the material on archive is free to read. You don't have to sign up for anything. You can just read all of the papers. And often the first place you see them is on archive. Like, I'd say 80% of the papers that make it to journals were already published on archive. So the entire scientific process for astronomy, and really for most sciences, is incredibly open, just done at near real time, and nobody is watching, and nobody is like trying to stop anybody, and nobody's trying to oversee anything. And so, and the way these kinds, like, we think about Oumuamua, right? That when Oumuamua, the first interstellar object discovered here in the solar system, like, somebody reported spotting an asteroid that was moving on a trajectory that suggested that it might be moving on a hyperbolic trajectory, that it was going to probably leave the solar system. And then other astronomers turned their telescopes on the same object and evaluated it and confirmed the trajectory. And then people started to point larger telescopes at it. But the secret was out. Like, everyone was talking about it at that point. So I think, like, people, before they have, like, experienced what it's like to be part of the scientific community and just how much of a cacophony of voices and programs and telescopes and places and NASA and space agencies and all this, before people experience that directly, they don't realize just how much of a kind of vibrant ecosystem it all is and how impossible it would be to hide any information. And also, you know, astronomers wouldn't shut up about it, right? They love to explain and try to, and there's sort of a great saying, I forget how it works, but, you know, you don't have to worry about people stealing your ideas. If your ideas are any good, you're going to have to jam them down people's throats. That the only way that people make progress in science really is by sharing the results, having debates and feedback with other scientists, and hammering away on problems until the truth finally reveals itself. And that just does not play well with secrecy. And so, you know, anytime anyone suggests that there's some kind of, I mean, not even conspiracy, just like some kind of attempted cover-up, some kind of way that various people in charge are hiding. Like I immediately discount that idea because of just how open and vibrant scientific progress is. El Cosmodos Drago. What's your view on the whole NASA is avoiding looking for life conspiracy between delays to MSR, Dragonfly not going to lakes, and placing the Uranus orbiter ahead of the Enceladus orbilander? Well, I think that's ridiculous, obviously, that, you know, that there's any kind of vast conspiracy that is says that NASA or, you know, any space agency is looking to delay. I mean, you may have the Mars sample return mission sort of falling apart because the budget was starting to expand outside of what anyone was willing to pay. But the Chinese are still planning to do their sample return mission. You know, I think the whole search for life took a serious blow back in the 1970s with the Viking experiment, right? So, you know, when the Viking landers went to Mars, they had these really cool experiments on board where they would pick up some Martian regolith, they would feed it some nutrients, they would increase the temperature, give it some water, and would then measure the outgassing that happened in the experiment. And that would tell you whether or not there was just microbes living in the regolith. And the problem was that the outcome was inconclusive. Now, some people are absolutely certain that life was found on Mars, and other people are not sure that life was actually found on Mars. And they think that, in fact, these are just natural outgassing from the kinds of chemicals that were in the regolith, and no one can really double check. You know, you could obviously you could send another mission, but you might just get another inconclusive result. And then you had the Allen Hills meteorite, where, you know, if you remember President Clinton announcing that life had, you know, had been found on Mars, and, you know, here we are 20 years after that, and nobody thinks that that meteorite was evidence of life on Mars. It was interesting, but definitely not conclusive. And so this this sort of running forward to try to prove that there's life on Mars or on any other place in the solar system had to like slow down, and that they wanted to build this overwhelming conclusive case that there actually is life on another planet, or if there isn't. And so that's how you saw Spirit and Opportunity, which were just looking for any possible evidence that there was ever water on Mars, and they did. And then you got Curiosity, which was trying to find out whether or not there had been water on Mars for long periods of time in the ancient past, and it did. And now you got Perseverance, which is saying, were there conditions for life? Were there the kinds of organic chemicals? Were there the kinds of raw materials available to be present for life? And in that, the, you know, the jury is still out. This found a lot of really interesting things, but, you know, the work is still ongoing as Perseverance still searches around. And so, you know, all of those things that you mentioned, Dragonfly is not going to the lakes, you know, there's lots of good technical reasons why you wouldn't send a helicopter to the sort of extreme poles of Titan. Having a Uranus orbiter ahead of an Enceladus orbilander, I mean, landing near the Tiger Stripes on the South Pole of Enceladus is really complicated. And a lot of this stuff is all still up in the air. I mean, nothing, no firm schedule has been set for when these various missions are going to go. But finding evidence of life in the universe, finding evidence of life in the solar system, is one of the most important discoveries that humanity can possibly make. It tells us that life has, you know, maybe formed independently on other places here in the solar system or out there in the universe, or maybe we're related to life here in the solar system through panspermia. But either way, you get one of the most impactful sort of pieces of scientific knowledge that has ever fallen into the hands of humanity. And so you want to be sure. You don't want to go through times where people are inconclusive. Nobody argues that water was once present on the surface of Mars. The evidence is overwhelming And that's what you want to get to with life. You want to go have the evidence be overwhelming. Nobody questions it. But that requires being very, very careful, doing a really good job, sending the right equipment, you know, with the right resolution, the right experiments, to be able to get you a conclusive result. And when you consider how far away it is and how difficult it is to get to Mars or Enceladus or Uranus, that sending sufficient equipment to give you a conclusive result is an expensive process. And yet there's, you know, we've seen what happens if you take it, you know, if you don't get the conclusive result, then people just argue. And I think it makes the search for life just in general look less legitimate. So I think that's all that's going on. If you want to support the work we do at Universe Today, consider joining our Patreon club. Your support lets us have a minimum of ads and no sponsorship messages. Patrons get no ads on universetoday.com for life. Want the extra parts of the live stream that aren't in this edited version? You can sign up for a special patron-only podcast feed and get the overtime segments, as well as other special behind-the-scenes episodes, including our monthly patron-only question show. Thanks to everyone who has already subscribed, and welcome to our recent newcomers. Mr. Pink, Benjamin Carrier, Ruth Petitsky, Gordon Fulton, Santiago Tranfo, and David Sprout. Join the club at patreon.com/universetoday. Astronomy 66. I don't understand the Hubble tension. How will resolving the differences in the expansion rate calculations advance science? What will scientists be able to do with this information? So the Hubble tension, this is a measurement of the expansion rate of the universe that doesn't agree with two different measurements. So there are many ways to measure the expansion rate of the universe. I mean, we know that galaxies are moving away from us in all directions. And when you measure that expansion rate of the universe, you get one number. And that also you can measure the expansion rate of the universe in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And when you compare the measurement in the CMB versus the speed of galaxies moving away from us, you get a different number. And the number is close, but the number is not the same. And for the longest time, the error bars of the two numbers overlapped. And so people just assumed that the error bars were going to go away, that the two measurements would finally settle in on what is the right number for the expansion rate of the universe. And what they found was as they got better and better at measuring the expansion rate, the two error bars narrowed down, but they didn't overlap. And so you got these two numbers. And now the people who are measuring the expansion rate of the universe based on the galaxies are really certain, and they've double-checked their numbers. They've double-checked their numbers and triple-checked them. And then the people who've measured it from the cosmic microwave background have done the same, and they are absolutely sure that they have measured the expansion rate of the universe properly. And those numbers disagree, and that is the Hubble tension. So why is that important? Well, where it's important is that you have to explain it, right? Why? How could, you know, if the expansion rate of the universe is really well understood and can be tracked over vast periods of time, how is it that you get these different numbers? So the one possibility is that it's a measurement error, that someone has made a mistake somewhere with either the measurement relatively nearby or the measurement that is made in the cosmic microwave background. That's almost always the answer, is that somebody's made a measurement mistake. And yet the people who have made these measurements are the best in the business and have done really good work. People have double-checked their work. People have double-checked the double-checking of the work, and these numbers hold. Then what you're left with is that your underlying assumptions, your theories about the universe itself, the way the universe has evolved over time, are missing something, that there is new physics, that maybe at some point, at some weird middle time over the expansion of the universe, things sped up and then slowed down again, or maybe have continued to speed up and then only recently slowed down, or maybe it sped up at a time before that first measurement was done. And each one of those then has to be explained, like what could cause the universe to change the rate of its expansion beyond the factors that have already been accounted for. And that's what makes this really exciting. You know, people call the Hubble tension, it's like they call it the crisis in cosmology. And a crisis makes you think there's something bad happening. But this is an opportunity, because the theories about the nature of the universe haven't provided a lot of places to look for things that don't fit. It's when you look for the things that don't fit that you can start to expand the theories and start to understand things at a more deep level. It's the weird stuff, the anomalies. Those are your guide to deeper theories about the nature of reality. And cosmologists are fortunate enough to be getting these cracks, these weird anomalies, and they're then having to try to chase them down and figure out the source of them. So I think, you know, the Hubble tension is this sort of revolution in our understanding of the universe, an opportunity to go back and figure out some of these deeply held understandings that so far have just been, have beautifully explained the evolution of the universe over time. And now you can see that there is deeper theory. And we know there must be deeper theories. When you think about the fact that quantum mechanics and gravity can't be sort of connected in any meaningful way, it tells you that there's more to this universe than we understand. Why was there more matter than antimatter in the early universe? Why do we see these large-scale structures of the universe that shouldn't be possible? And it's only in starting to find these interesting anomalies that you can start to more deeply understand the laws of physics in the universe that we find ourselves. So it's a really exciting time in cosmology, and you know, we're going to see a lot of really interesting work get done. And good news is that, like, a lot of really great tools have come online in the last couple of years. We see the Euclid mission, there's the upcoming Nancy Grace Roman, there's the Vera Rubin Observatory, there's the DESI, the Dark Energy Survey Instrument. So there's a lot of really great tools that have just come online to try and help answer this problem at a time when we need the tools. So it's really good timing. Rev MSJ, what happens when we reach the Great Attractor? Something or nothing? So from what we can tell, the Great Attractor is a concentration of galaxies on the far side of the Milky Way. It just happens to be that the core of the Milky Way obscures our view from the far side of it. But thanks to infrared telescopes, thanks to radio telescopes, we're mostly able to see through the dust and gas of the plane of the Milky Way and see what's going on the far side, to see all of these galaxies that are sort of gravitationally connected, bound as part of the Great Attractor. And like, what is a Great Attractor? It's a galaxy cluster that we are a part of, a larger sort of concentration of galaxies in the universe. And so, you know, what happens when we reach it? Well, we're kind of already in it and we will never reach it. So, you know, the Milky Way is bound to Andromeda, an M33 galaxy, those are the three big spiral galaxies, and then a cluster of dwarf galaxies. And those are the ones that will eventually merge into some larger elliptical galaxy billions of years down the road. But all the other galaxies that we can see in the universe are moving away from us, and in fact seem to be accelerating away from us thanks to dark energy. And so we will always be moving away from the Great Attractor. Now, we are still gravitationally influenced by the galaxies in the Great Attractor. It's changing the direction that the Milky Way is moving away from the Great Attractor and other galaxies in general, but we will not end up inside the Great Attractor. We will only end up bound up and form a large, you know, we'll only merge with Andromeda, the Trianum galaxies, and all those dwarf galaxies around us. Everything else will just move away faster and faster and eventually fall over the cosmic horizon, including the entire Great Attractor. All right. Thanks everyone who asked questions both in the YouTube comments as well as everybody who showed up for the live show that we record. Now we're going to have the time for the next live show somewhere here on the channel. And so just make sure you click on the notification bell. So if you want to be able to join that live, it's a lot of fun. About 600 people show up and just hammer me with questions for 2 hours. All right. I want to talk about the book club, but first I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew M. Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, David Giltinan, David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Chiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So one of the things that we've been doing on the channel is maintaining a book club, and this is very simplified. We're not reading the books together. You are telling me, you are controlling me, you are the puppet master telling me the books that you want me to read, and I am going to then read the book as ordered and then provide my review here on the channel so that other people can find out about that book and enjoy it or not enjoy it. So the link to the book club is going to be down in the show notes, but it's at Goodreads. And so you can join this community, list books that you want me to read, and then I will pick from this list and I will read them and I will tell you what I think. And I've kind of run out of books. So go to that Goodreads community and go ahead and post some suggestions that you have. All right. Happy reading, and we'll see you next time.